Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to give Israel's parliament the ability to overturn high court decisions has been met with widespread protests. What are the stakes of these protests? What's the democratic and political future for Israel? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Israeli politics are dominated by the politically divisive figure of Benjamin Netanyahu. The country has had five elections in the last 3 years, the most recent late in 2022, resulting in a coalition once again led by the Likud leader. And the prime minister has sought to alter the Israeli political structure with proposals to allow parliament to overrule decisions made by Israel's high court. Opponents of this proposal have protested throughout the nation, often with extremely large and vocal demonstrations. So in today's show, we will explore these proposals and their impact on Israeli democracy, as well as the personal politics of the Israeli prime minister, the protest movement against the government, and its impact on Israeli politics and policies. Our panel today is Mira Sukharov, professor of political science in the Department of Political Science at Carleton University. She's the author of The International Self, Psychoanalysis and the Search for Israeli-Palestinian Peace, and is a co-editor of Social Justice in Israel-Palestine, Foundational and Contemporary Debates. And Liran Lavi is assistant professor in the Department of Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. She is the author of King Bibi, The Personification of Democratic Values in the 2019-2021 Election Cycle, recently published in the book The Election in Israel, 2019-2021. Thank you both very much for joining us. Mira Sukharov, I'll start with you. There's a lot of elections Israel's had recently in political stability. What happened in the last election?
Well, you're right that there's been a lot of elections, so much so that it's really become a bit of a joke, bit of something to sort of giggle about in Israeli politics. But this particular coalition and what they're trying to do, I would say, is no laughing matter. This coalition makes Bibi Netanyahu's Likud party look moderate by comparison. So there's six parties, and they are some of them are openly homophobic as a matter of pride in their own view, and others are ultra orthodox. So they're looking in those cases, they'd be looking to protect their young men from avoiding the draft. And there are also right-wing settler parties and Shas, which is the Mizrahi or Sephardi, sometimes it's called, and that means Jews from Middle East or North Africa. It's the Mizrahi Orthodox Party. And it used to be that Shas was considered a more dovish party back when the Oslo Agreement was passed through the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, back in 1993. Shas really helped that vote pass. So, but I think the point is that all parties in Israel have particular agendas that they're trying to push, and coalition dynamics help them do that.
And part of what they're trying to push here, Mira, is this proposal to alter Israeli politics, particularly at an institutional level. What is the prime minister's proposal to alter that, the role the high court plays?
Mm-hmm. There's a range of what are typically known as judicial reforms, but Israelis see them much more in a revolutionary way as much more overturning the integrity of democracy. So we can even talk, I'll be interested to hear what Liron has to say about even the term reform. Is that a bit of a whitewash term? But in any event, there's various laws, that is a neutral term for sure, that the government is trying to put forth. I mean, we can go over some of them, but probably the most alarming one for the strength of or for the integrity of a democratic system is that Israel is seeking, the Israeli government, I should say, is seeking to no longer give the courts the last word, such that it used to be that the courts, the Israeli High and Supreme Court, could overturn a law that went against basic dignity principles, that went against Israel's basic laws. We can get to those in a minute. And under these proposed laws, under this new proposed law, the parliament could override the courts overriding. So in other words, it's known as the override clause, that the government would have, the parliament would have the last say. And so what this does is it really jeopardizes basic human and civil rights in terms of Israeli society. It jeopardizes basic what Americans would think of as constitutional rights, what Canadians would think of as charter rights. Israel doesn't have a constitution, but it does have a series of basic laws that serve to protect basic rights of dignity. And so women, women's rights advocates are viewing this as an attack on women, LGBTQ identified individuals as well, could be an attack on Palestinians. And then we're not even getting into the question of the West Bank occupation and the Gaza siege continuing apace, but we'll get there too.
No, absolutely. And Liran Lavi, I want to bring you in as well. I mean, Mira raises one question about whether or not it's best to conceptualize this as judicial reforms, or is there a better way to think about what these proposals are?
Yes, so absolutely. It's a fight over the narrative and the discourse, as well as the content of the bill themselves. So reform is the word that the coalition, the government has to describe what it is doing. The protesters or the opposers of this changes, those bills, would call it an overhaul, even a coup, a soft coup. It's not military, but it definitely changed from, you know, the foundation of Israeli democracy. So yes, all those protesters that we see for 16 weeks now in Israel would definitely not call it a reform.
And to follow that up, here in the United States, where I've heard and been following some of these discourses, there's quite a bit of a debate as to how much these reforms, the overhauls, coup, constitute a threat to Israeli democracy. How much is this package, this call for an overhaul, these attempts to try to overhaul, how much does threatens core democratic principles within Israel?
Taken together, Mira had mentioned one of them, the ability of the Knesset to override Supreme Court decisions. And it's important to note that in the Israeli system, the coalition has a built-in majority in the parliament, in the Knesset. So it basically gives any government an ability to override any court decision. And in addition, they would give the government a majority in the committee that selects the Supreme Court judges, and will restrict the ability of the Supreme Court to overrule unconstitutional laws that are passed in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament. So taken together, they are definitely causing a very unprecedented alarm in the Israeli public. Although it's not the first time that the Israeli public is alarmed for its democracy, but we haven't seen such protests in Israel's history before. And indeed, if all those bills would have passed together as one, as one plan, that would definitely change some of the basic foundations. It is important to keep in mind that Israel, to begin with, is what some call a flawed liberal democracy, or an ethnic democracy, it's sometimes being called, in terms that it's not the classic liberal democracy that we would think of from Western democracies. And so this reform curbs the already weak or already flawed liberal elements of Israeli democracy has. And this is part of the concern here.
And Mira, it sounds like, I mean, part of a general democratic principle is that there's at least certain lines that can't be crossed in the United States, constitutional lines, Bill of Rights sorts of questions meant to protect the public from majority rule. I know Canada has some of those same principles. So in that context, I know there have been some concerns internationally about countries and democratic backsliding concerns, where in essence, the guardrails that will protect society from certain acts that can't be implemented just because a coalition has been put together that has majority rule wants to have these passed. Is it fair to describe that what's going on in Israel, what's at stake at Israel, is very similar to trends that we've seen in other countries that have seen these guardrails eroding, and the potential that under the guise of, well, the majority wants this because we've been able to put together a majority government, they're going to be able to act in ways that generally would be considered outside of the capabilities of governments because of these guardrails?
Absolutely. And it's no surprise that Bibi Netanyahu has been cozying up to an increasing number of authoritarian-leaning world leaders. So just consider this. In the US, I mean, there was a lot of talk about whether Trump, president at the time, Trump could be deemed unfit for rule. And there was a lot of talk about that. In Israel, under the current government, under Bibi Netanyahu's government proposals, their proposed bills, and which they hope to move into law, there would be no such constraints. So if a prime minister was deemed unfit to rule, he or she could still legally rule if their reforms or bills that they want to see pass. It would be much easier. Here, another example of a bill they're trying to put through, would be much easier for the government to pass a law and stamp the term basic law on it. And remember, in Israel, there's no formal constitution, but basic laws have a sort of de facto constitutional status. So they could pass, on one hand, they could pass a basic law and then term it basic, call it basic, that inherently discriminates against some sort of vulnerable population in their citizenry. On the other hand, they want to override the court's ability to say that a discriminatory law defies the current basic law, including, for example, the one of human dignity. So they're trying to really have full maneuverability with no constraints. And I think that's a really good way of saying it, is the guardrails are coming down. And that's why that's why Liron's article called him King Bibi. And that's why Israelis are talking about the dictator. And they just refer to him very loosely as Hadik Dadol.
You said something that I want to get a clarification. So the basic law within Israel is not something that just was passed upon its founding or, you know, sort of dates back. Sounds like, can Parliament just designate anything as a part of basic law at this point? Or how does something become basic law in the Israeli context?
Liron might know better. I think there needs to be some sort of supermajority vote.
Liron, I'll ask you that question.
Well, surprisingly, yes, it's very, very simple to pass a law as a basic law, and then it's very, very easy to change it. So some of the bills that we actually discuss here as part of this so-called reform is not a bill in itself, but it's actually an amendment to a basic law. And it can be done with a simple majority, not even an absolute majority of 61 out of the Knesset 120 members. So just 2-1. And
so then in that context, what you're saying is obviously in the United States, you can amend a constitution, but the process is very long, lengthy, takes tremendous support. In Israel, they just don't have that as a guardrail to say you can amend it, but it's very difficult. In Israel, they don't really have that guardrail, is what you're saying.
Right. Israel misses a lot of the guardrail that other democracies have. For example, constitution is one example, but we also have just one house. We don't have two houses. As I said earlier, the coalition comes from the parliament. So the legislature and the executive branches are really intertwined into one another. The Supreme Court and its ability to overrule some of the laws and the place that it has taken to itself to check and balance the other branches is pretty much the only guardrail that Israel democracy has. everything else either do not exist or very easy to change and manipulate.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the proposals to alter governance structures, to overhaul the Israeli judicial system, and the protests in Israel that have resulted from those proposals. And our panel today is Mira Sukharov from Carleton University and Liran Lavi of Bar-Ilan University in Israel. And Liran, next area here then is one of the great guardrails for democracy is the ability to protest. Of people taking to the streets and saying, whatever the government is proposing, we oppose. So first of all, how extensive have the protests been and the impact of the protests on this discourse?
So they have been extremely intensive. We see here in Israel, the 16 weeks of protest. Every week, more than 500,000 Israelis out of Israel's 9 million population go out to the streets. So in US terms, it would be around 10 million citizens every week, sometimes in the middle of the week. But it's not only the numbers. It's very, the protests are very, very broad in terms that it includes all sorts of population and groups from Israeli society, including right-wing and left-wing. So in no term, they could be defined as leftist protests. And in terms of intensity, especially towards the end of the Knesset session at the beginning of April, where we saw IDF reservists saying that they won't report to duty if this reform would be passed. If in for Israeli society, that kind of killing them or breaking the Holy Grail, the very one of the last consensus left in Israeli society. And eventually, although the government has declared that it will pass at least some of the laws before the Knesset session would end, they didn't. Partly at least because of the intense and very broad protests that we have seen here in the last 3 months or so.
And on that IDF question, one story that I was familiar with and been following was the firing, the sacking of the defense minister, correct? What's the nature, what happened there with the defense minister's firing?
Right, so the coalition was able to keep very close ranks through all of this, and despite those growing protests and a lot of pressure, international pressures and inner pressures within Israel, and the coalition kept very close ranks. No one went against the reform. Until the defense minister went out, did a press conference, and said that he thinks that it should be stopped or at least put into a pause and reach a broader agreement, public agreement, before going further with the bills. 48 hours later, Netanyahu fires the defense minister. And in the midst of in a very, very security-wise tense period in Israel, and then following that, very spontaneously, all hail Berkeley's, people went out to the streets, you know, in the intense of a very spontaneous protest. The sense was that that for the sake of this reform, anything would go, even firing a defense minister, despite very serious security threat and a very intense period security-wise. And after that, there was a day after, there was a strike, a national strike for the first time. At the end of that day, Netanyahu declared, went to his own press conference, saying that he decided to pause the legislation for now. The Knesset has, the session has ended, and they would try to negotiate the coalition and the opposition and reach some kind of agreement.
Now, Mira, one of the things that I find particularly striking is the election was not this sort of sweeping victory for the prime minister, correct? I mean, one of the reasons why we've had so many elections is it's fair to say that politically, Israel's a deeply divided society. And it seems like each of the coalitions come, any coalition that's put together is always tenuous because just from a numbers perspective, it's hard to get to 61 seats, which seems to be an indication that at a minimum, it's fair to say, it's not as though the Israeli electorate has spoken with any definitive, you know, statement of preference, even, you know, support or oppose Netanyahu. So it's a deeply divided society. And trying to overhaul fundamental political relationships between the courts and the Knesset under a deeply divided society seems to be an absolute invitation for this level of protest and this level of political turmoil. So why pursue it with such a small majority?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple of things here. So one is, why would Netanyahu pursue it? Well, this is very much on brand for Netanyahu. He'll do whatever it takes to continue his reign. And so that would mean shoring up governmental power in the face of the courts. It would mean passing a bill into a law, as he's trying to do, that would help entrench his hold, that would help ensure that ministers who have been found guilty of crimes are still allowed to serve if the prime minister wishes them to. So he's very much trying to shore up his own power. So that's not super surprising. But one thing to note that I think you're noting well is that, so on one hand, we could say, well, why are Israelis protesting? They're the ones who elected this government. But recall that it's a parliamentary system with it's a parliamentary system, and it runs on a proportional representation system, meaning that the whole country is a single political unit. And the number of seats that every party gets is a direct function of the percentage of votes each party got, except that Israel keeps raising the threshold to get in. So that what we saw in the last election is that some parties, we've seen this before, but especially in the last election, the left-wing parties were really gutted because they didn't receive the minimum number of votes needed to gain even one seat. And that means that all those votes go wasted. Now, one way to not waste votes is for parties to band together in a vote-sharing agreement in advance of the elections. And they say, well, all those extra votes will be split among us, and then we'll have a better chance of securing one or two or three or extra seats. But the parties on the left didn't succeed in making agreements with each other. So that means the left was further gutted. So on one hand, you could say a population gets what they deserve when they go to the polls. But on the other hand, the particular structural elements of the electoral process doesn't always reflect the will of the people to the fullest extent.
And Liran Lavi, you called him King Bibi. What's behind that moniker?
Behind that is, of course, his political dominance. He is the most dominant political figure in Israel, probably equals to David Ben-Gurion, the founding father of Israel. But in recent years, it has become more than that. It seemed as if so, the very definition of the political axis, like the definition of right and left in Israel, became about Netanyahu, whether you're with Netanyahu or against him. So it's not about just the absolute power, but as the rest of the title of that paper suggests, he came to personify, to signify values and identities in the most profound ways. In a sense that we saw in public opinion survey that we ran, that Israelis, you know, define themselves less and less and define the election less and less about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which used to be the major issue of Israeli politics. So the election became much less about this issue, and most importantly, or centered around Netanyahu and whether he would be the prime minister or no, even though, as Mira rightly said, there are no election to prime minister in Israel. People vote for parties, and those parties form coalition and governments. So that's to speak to his dominance. But I think in what we're seeing right now in Israel is, yes, part of it is Netanyahu's dominance, for sure. And he has, and his legal issues and his desire to find a way out of those issues. But it's deeper. It's deeper than that. It's not about the person per se, so to speak. It's about what he signifies. It is about changing the power relation within Israeli society from the old ways and the classic Jewish and democratic model of Israel into a more Jewish, more emphasis on the Jewish in this Jewish and democratic duo. We saw that in the basic law, Israel, the nation, the homeland of the nation state, and we see it with this coalition and its overall aim to put emphasis on religion, on tradition.
When we come back, what role does Jewish identity play in Israel's politics? Stay with us.
Everything in life is a negotiation.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Israel is becoming increasingly religious in its governance. What does that mean for Jewish identity of the state? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're exploring the proposals in Israel to alter the relationship between the Knesset and the Israeli High Court, the judicial reform or overhaul proposals, the specific policies and the politics of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and what this means, the protests taking to the streets and the political turmoil throughout the country, and what this means for the future of Israeli politics, of Israeli identity, and the nature of the relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Our guests today are Mira Sukharov, professor of political science in the Department of Political Science at Carleton University, and Liran Lavi, assistant professor in the Department of Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. So Mira Sukharov, you highlighted so far some of the potential proposals about issues such as, you know, LGBTQ, women's rights, you know, generally sort of social progressive politics. And throughout Israel's history, they've had a pretty progressive record on social issues, from my understanding. How much is that at stake with these discourses that's backing away from some of these protections that Israel's actually been pretty well known for?
Any marginalized group would be under even greater threat than they already are if these judicial laws, these overhaul laws, these reform laws pass. That's for sure, because any minoritized group would be at the whim of a government. And remember, right now, if you're speaking of LGBTQ or women, we have openly homophobic parties in the current Israeli government coalition. The ultra-Orthodox are not always, are certainly not kind to women's rights as the women's movement would generally see them to be. Just one thing on LGBTQ rights in Israel. Israel certainly has wanted to portray itself as being very progressive on LGBTQ issues. The Israeli Pride Parade is a celebrated event by the Tel Aviv municipality. There are rainbow colors painted onto crosswalks along the beach in Israel. It's an amazing beach party. But remember that Israel sometimes promotes these things as a way, critics would say, as a way of detracting from its human rights violations in the occupied territories. And what's more, while a same-sex couple can go abroad and get married and come back to Israel and have their marriage recognized according to international law, something that Israel does adhere to in this case, there's no same-sex marriage for Israelis in Israel. That's because there is no civil marriage, period. All marriage has to go through religious authorities. And while the more liberal strands of Judaism, such as the conservative movement to an extent, and the reform movement and reconstructionist movement in Israel, in anywhere, the reform and reconstructionist, and to some extent the conservative strands of Judaism recognize same-sex marriage, none of those rabbis in Israel have marriage rights. Israel only grants life cycle adjudication rights to Orthodox rabbis, and that's in the Jewish sector. And then there would be religious leaders in the Muslim and Christian sector who would do their own ceremonies for their own people. But that means there's no cross-religious marriage, civil marriage in Israel. A Muslim and a Jew can't show up to City Hall and get married because there is no City Hall type of avenue for marriage. Neither can two women or two men show up and get married in Israel.
So, Liran Lavi, I'll extend the question to you as well. How much of this Jewish identity, first of all, how progressive have Israeli politics been on these, particularly these social issues, and how much of that is at risk?
I think what Mira just described in terms of marriages and who can get married and how, kind of a good picture of how, of the role of religion in Israeli public life in general. So for example, there is no public transportation on Saturdays, it's a holiday, and there's no public transportation. There have been some local initiatives over the last 5 or 10 years for public transportation on Saturdays, but those are, they didn't become national and would be under threat. There is the initiative for opening national parks on Saturdays for free. And the minister that is in charge of that declared that he would stop this program and would introduce instead a program that will encourage Israeli Jews to come to synagogues on Friday nights instead. So all sorts of initiatives and changes that are softer, but at the same time, we see some more aggressive moves. For example, one of the laws that have been passed in the Knesset is what we call the Chametz Law. It's a law that prohibits to get during a little introduction during Passover. Jews do not eat anything that is made of flour. So the law prohibits people of any religion to get into public hospitals with chametz, with food that is made of flour, and allows for public hospital to actually search your private belongings to see that you adhere to this law. Also, when if you dig a little deeper in the law that under the proposal that are on their way in the legislation process, there is a proposal to extend the role of rabbinical courts to civil matters. All those will increase the role of religion in Israeli public life.
Yeah, so Mira, there's an identity, a core identity question. I mean, Israel is a Jewish state, but Jewish hasn't always meant religious and particularly conservative religious expression. Jewish, you know, can come in many different forms, from cultural, certainly, you know, questions about ethnic identity, religious identity, et cetera. There's been this whole process in Israel, particularly in the last decade or two, to try to narrow what the Jewish part of Jewish identity means, to define it as a conservative religious identity. At least that's my understanding. Is a fair description? What does this mean for Israel if that succeeds?
Yeah, there's a couple of things at play here. One is what Jewish identity means for Israeli Jewish citizens. And so when two Jews want to marry each other, but don't want to give the Israeli rabbinate control over their wedding, they themselves will go to Cyprus or Las Vegas and get married by Elvis and return back to their home country, Israel, and Israel will have to, as we mentioned, accept that marriage as legal domestically inside Israel. And that's an example of when two Jews don't like how Judaism is being defined for them, in that there's one type of Judaism, it's the Orthodox common denominator, and Liron has given a perfect example of that, but the Chametz law. There are Jews who adhere to Passover dietary laws, and there are Jews who don't adhere to Passover dietary laws. And according to this, all Jews have to express their Judaism in the same way in public spaces. The next issue is what the effect of being a so-called Jewish state is on non-Jews in Israel. And we know that 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinian. Palestinians pretty much by definition are not Jewish. The vast majority of Palestinians in Palestine are Muslim. Some are also Christian. And so when you have a state that sees itself as Jewish and that is part of its core identity, and that uses Zionism as a governing ideology, you get a range of very negative material effects historically and up till today on non-Jews. And so historically that primarily meant Palestinians, who were the target of ethnic cleansing around the prior to the 48 war and during, and in a series of events, small micro events that added up to what Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, the catastrophe. And more recently, those policies have continued apace in terms of not direct ethnic cleansing, but certainly home demolitions in the West Bank, forms of collective punishment, unequal laws for Jewish municipalities and majority Jewish village towns and villages and settlements versus Arab towns in terms of granting building permits. And then you have all the issues of the occupation in terms of major human rights violations against Palestinians. And you also have another subset of non-Jews in Israel who live in Israel who get the short end of the stick in terms of rights, and those are asylum seekers. So all these rights deficits, civil rights and human right deficits, I would argue are an extension of a state that wants to be known as a democracy, but also thinks of itself as a Jewish state rather than as a democracy that protects and nurtures the multiple cultures within it.
And Liron, your thoughts on that same issue?
I would like to add that when we think about those protests that we see on the streets, what they really call for is what Mira so nicely and Sally described as a country that wants to see itself as a democracy while violating democratic and liberal aspects of democracy, both within its border and definitely in its occupied territories. And their call, the call of the protesters are to this country. This is what they want back. So you'll see in the protest the Israeli flag. Like they re-own the Israeli flag after they felt that the right wing and Jewish and Jewish settlers have kind of identified themselves with those national symbols. So we'll see the flag and we'll see the national anthem being sung. They are all very heavily Jewish in their context and in their symbol. And in this term, not surprisingly, we almost don't see Palestinian citizens of Israel as part of those demonstrations. It's as if this discourse and political battle is within the Jewish population in Israel, within the Jewish majority, over the question of whether Israel will be predominantly Jewish or Jewish and democratic. And the question of whether Israel will be fully democratic is not there. And therefore, although the Palestinian citizens of Israel will be probably the first and maybe most vulnerable to this reform or the consequence of this reform, they're not part of those demonstrations. When we look at those demonstrations and the discourse that and what it and what they ask and what the protesters want.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing political protests and what that means for the Jewish state and what the Jewish state means for Israel with our guests, Mira Sukharov of Carleton University and Liran Lavi of Bar-Ilan University in Israel. So Mira, what Liran just raised is a potential real limitation for the hopes that maybe these protests might fundamentally alter some of the political discourse and what appeared to be political pathways that had been increasingly becoming more right-wing Jewish in Israel. Been some hope that maybe the protests might change that. But Liran Lavi suggests that's probably not going to be one of the results. Are you fairly pessimistic or optimistic about the protests altering the trajectories of Israeli politics?
I'm equally pessimistic, as Liran pointed out, as she described. I mean, there are pockets of protesters who are seeking to link the judicial overhaul initiatives, the anti-democratic initiatives of the current government, seeking to link those moves with the occupation. So they'll have t-shirts saying no democracy without occupation. But those numbers are few and far between. And I think it has been a strategic choice on the part of the protesters to use the Israeli flag, as Liran said. And you could make an argument, the Israeli flag is the flag of the state and 20% of the state's citizens are Palestinian and it's their flag too. But let's be honest, Palestinian citizens of Israel don't feel that that flag represents them. I mean, it's a Star of David for God's sake, just to use a little bit of fun, right? It's the two stripes invoking the tallit, the Jewish prayer shawl. It's very much a Jewish flag. Now, that said, were Israel to end the occupation, were Palestinian citizens of Israel to gain full equal rights in a way that they don't have? I mean, they can vote, they can run for parliament, they can serve in the courts, but there are a range, as we've mentioned a little bit, a range of limitations in practice on their civil rights vis-a-vis Jewish Israelis. I mean, were that all to equalize, maybe they would then see the flag as their own, but that would take a lot of work. And so, Israeli protests, there is a precedent for this, and think about the 2011 protests that were known as the tent protests that were triggered by the price of cottage cheese. They were very much an economic protest, not a judicial protest. They were an economic protest, and they also wanted to create a big tent. And because the way to have a protest succeed is to have as many people hit the streets as possible. The way to have as many people hit the streets as possible is to say we're big tent and we're not going to bring up issues that are so-called divisive. One of the issues that are so-called divisive within Israeli society, of course, is the occupation. Not all Israelis even use that word. Palestinians, fate of Palestinians. And so Israeli protesters prefer to focus the protests on the democratic overhaul and to make it a bit of a referendum on Bibi. Remember, very recently, even before the most recent elections, there were massive protests urging Bibi to step down. And those less prominent was the Israeli flag. And those protests, more prominent was a black and white specific banner and flag that said had two letters left, meaning go in the imperative, and the go was directed at Bibi himself. So Israelis have really been riled up on the political front, on the party front, on the prime minister front, and now on the democratic overhaul front. The plight of the Palestinians has taken a back seat and continues to.
Another layer connected to what we said earlier about the role of Netanyahu in Israeli politics and how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict becomes less prevalent in defining Israeli politics and right and left in Israeli politics. So part of the resistance that we see is a process where the Israeli center and left redefine themselves after so many years with no peace negotiation, with no real prospect to a resolution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And many Israelis, if not most of them, Jewish Israelis at least, have come to accept that there is no viable solution to the conflict, and we will just, you know, manage the conflict, as they say today. And we saw the Israeli left getting smaller and smaller. And as I said, part of what we see now is is an attempt of the Israeli left to redefine itself, not vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So a position regarding the future of this conflict, or a future two-state solution or any other solution, is almost by definition not part of this, of what we see right now.
So then it seems like the protesters, Liron, are not embracing the Palestinian communities, certainly definitely not addressing the occupation issue, and that as a strategic choice, right? That they, because it would be easier for the right, easier for Netanyahu and his supporters to simply call the protesters not loyal Israelis if they're raising that issue. Is that one of the primary reasons why they chosen not to embrace this question?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it was part of it. And you could see it was very interesting to look at this, at these developments, how in the first few weeks of the protests, there were Palestinian flags in the protests. And there was this huge debate within the protesters whether it's okay, whether this issue should be part of the demonstration. And starting at week 3 or so of the demonstration, you stopped seeing Palestinian flags. Yeah, and it was a strategic at a couple of levels. One is that they didn't want it to make easy on Netanyahu to label them as leftists, which became a bad word in Israeli politics, kind of equal of traitors. So that's one thing. And on another level, it was their aim to, as Mira said, kind of putting a broad tent and include center and soft right wing voters to bring them too into those protests and paint this reform as an apolitical subject. It's not about politics. It's deeper than that. It's a democracy or a dictatorship. And at the third level is this reshaping of the left or the center left in Israel, not in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
And so, Mira, we started off talking about how part of the reason why this coalition, why Netanyahu was able to put together this coalition, which historically, if it's not the furthest right-wing coalition, it's pretty close to it, that has governed Israel. But part of that is because the Israeli left has been performing pretty poorly electorally, and whether it's they're below the threshold and they're moving the threshold or whatever. But one of the narratives has been that the Israeli left just, I mean, even the Labor Party, there's just seemingly no real opportunity to even have any sort of center-left coalition. It seems like that in the elections, it's which choice of right versus center-right coalitions. So how much has this collapse of the Israeli left created this political crisis?
Yeah, certainly part of it is that there is a very small and weak Israeli left. The other is that but in recent years, there's been the rise of an Israeli center, a couple of centrist parties, and they have taken votes that would otherwise have gone to Labor and Meretz. And part of their success, for instance, Yair Lapid, has been an anti-clerical, an anti-church, a support of the separation of religion and state. And so that's part of how the left has been hollowed out. Nevertheless, he wasn't able to mount in any way a significant counteroffensive to this new government. And you're right that it is the most right-wing government that Israel's had in Israel's history.
So then, there is no Israeli left. Basically, the debate is between two right or right-center parties, one that embraces a welding of church and state versus a separation of church and state. And that's really at the core of what is Israeli politics these days. Mary?
Certainly, a big part of it is the role of religion. And we talked a bit about that, protection of the Haredi, of the ultra-Orthodox youth from being drafted. There had been legal attempts to draft them, and those have been found to be quite toothless. And so now the new government, the coalition members, will try to stop that. Other coalition members are pushing for expansion of settlements. Others are pushing for de facto annexation of parts of the West Bank. And one of Israel's ministers has been promised his own National Guard, which really is frightening in terms of basic civil and human rights at the day-to-day level.
Absolutely. And then so, Liran, this will be our last question. And that is the proposal to overhaul the relationship between the Knesset and the courts has been put on hold. But the expectation is at least some version of that is going to come back. Is there any indication as to when that will be proposed? And is there any sense about how close to the original kind of complete overhaul any of these proposals that will eventually be presented before the Knesset are going to be? Are we basically going to debate the same issue? The Israelis will debate the same issue just in a future time? Or is it really going to be pulled back?
That's the million-dollar question. All bets are off with this. I would cautiously say, or like draw the timeline, the near future timeline, the Knesset is back in session beginning of May, and the government needs to pass the budget first by the end of May. Otherwise, the Knesset will be dissolved and Israel will go to election once more. So as I said, cautious estimation is that we won't see anyone rocking the boat in the next month or so, because they will be focused on the budget. It's a little complicated because the Haredi parties have said they will support the budget only if the government will pass the draft bill that is very, very controversial in Israel. And the Supreme Court is likely to overrule it. This is why they wanted to override bill in the first place. So, but it's obvious that the public response would be fierce, if anything like that would go. So it will come down to political maneuvers of whether the parties, or the calculation of the coalition parties, whether they are willing to risk it and roll the election dice again, or go with the bill and, you know, will try to pass over the wave of resistance, or they will compromise on those bills. So
it seems like Israel is sort of stuck with, they've got these very controversial bills, including the overhaul, but the draft bill, the budget, and what's potentially on the table is, if they're not able to navigate that, navigate this, is likely a pretty good chance there could be a new election sometime relatively soon. Although I imagine most Israelis are a bit exhausted at the notion of elections since there's been so many of them. But at the end of the day, it seems as though the turmoil that we've seen, the protests, the reactions to government proposals, that this is not likely to alleviate anytime soon, and that Israel is going to remain in a pretty tense political position, in particular considering the incredibly high stakes that seems to be at play here, ranging from the nature of the Jewish identity of the Israeli state to the future of the democracy and whether or not what's at stake is a form of democratic backsliding that we've seen in other countries, that would be extremely, extremely concerning. So we've been talking today about the Israeli political crisis, Israeli political turmoil, the protests have taken to the streets, trends and trajectories within Israeli politics, and certainly the person of Benjamin Netanyahu and where he is positioned in all of these different debates. Our panel today has been Mira Sukharov. She's professor of political science at Carleton University, and she's the author of The International Self, Psychoanalysis and the Search for Israeli-Palestinian Peace, and is the co-editor of Social Justice and Israel-Palestine Foundational and Contemporary Debates. And Liran Lavi is assistant professor at the Department of Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. She's the author of King Bibi, The Personification of Democratic Values in the 2019-2021 Election Cycle, recently published in the book entitled The Election in Israel, 2019-2021. Thank you very much for providing your thoughts and your insights into this issue.
You're very welcome, Doug.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.